Greetings and a warm welcome to everyone tuning in as we are deep into the dark of December. I hope you're well. My name is Henrik Palmgren and this is the one and only Red Ice Radio. We investigate and analyze out of necessity the most important and interesting topics that at least we consider you should know about. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com, that's the websites. We have much more for you there. Today we're talking with Gavin Kearney. He's a musician, artist, and writer born in Cork, Ireland, but relocated to London in the early 90s, where he formed and played in various bands, as well as honoring his abilities as a painter. After completing a degree in fine arts, or sonic arts, Gavin began a recording career under the moniker Sand Snowman, and has to date released 9 albums, collaborating with such artists as Steve Wilson from Porcupine Tree and Storm Corrosion, Judy Dibley, Fairport Convention, Bobby Watson, Comus, and many others. Gavin is currently involved in a musical project with long-term musical and life partner Mono Swift. With music and art in the background, we are today going to talk about the state of the art, specifically modern art and what Gavin calls the death of cool. The marketing of counterculture, the development of the cult of personality around empty artists that have put focus on nothing but rot. Art is degrading into nothing but sensationalism. The success of art is often judged by how much attention it can get, and consequently the more subversive, disgusting, and pornographic it is, the more attention it gets. And this is now somehow mistaken for greatness. Mankind, led by the critics and the media pundits, have been led away from the art that conveys beauty, veneration for life, and is inspirational. And the focus today is basically on crude smut, death, and emptiness at best. So is this one emotion that is being attempted to be evoked all that art is about? Well, it sure looks like it. Isn't there more to art? What did it used to look like, and how did it get this way? Well, today we're going to try to answer some of those questions by talking about the conspiracy behind modern art. Welcome, Gavin. Excellent to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time off your busy schedule and talking with us today.
My pleasure, Henrik. I'm delighted to be here.
You bet. This is a very interesting topic. We have a lot of interesting stuff ahead of us here. Something that I've been thinking about myself for actually a long time and just watching where things have gone in terms of the art that many human beings now surround them with, and it doesn't only extend, of course, to the world of the paintings, but also sculptures and things that we see popping up in and around the cities, and this weird, in some cases, bizarre to the point of almost eerie art that we see around us. You know, so we'll get into this today here, Gavin. But before we do that, though, tell us just a little bit about your background as an artist and how you got into kind of this topic and watching modern art.
Well, I think to begin with, Henrik, because I mean, I've been drawing since I was a little toddler and painting for years. And one of the things that always struck me was when we're talking about like this kind of contemporary art, the stuff that tends to win, like say, the Turner Prize or gets a lot of media attention, I never seemed to meet anybody who genuinely liked it. And I was wondering, well, who is actually behind this and who is benefiting from this? And this was brought home to me very, very much when I went to art school. The first thing that was made very, very clear to me was that this model of contemporary art, one that isn't based so much on craft, but that's more based on, say, a conceptual approach, doesn't sit alongside traditional art. Traditional art is entirely rejected. And it's made quite clear to you that there is no place for it. Like, say, for example, if you start talking about traditional art, they kind of sneer at you and say, well, that's a chocolate box, meaning it's liked by people who don't know about art, therefore there's something wrong with it.
Right.
So it's made quite clear to you that there's no room for this. And if you don't effectively modify your position, if you don't change what you're doing, if you don't start citing the same references, if you don't start mirroring the opinions of your tutors, you find yourself very, very much outside of the loop with it. That was what really, really made a strong impression on me.
So you have to be educated to appreciate modern art.
Yes, re-educated.
Re-educated,
yeah. Educated or brainwashed, it depends on your point of view. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating, actually, because did you ever see that film, Full Metal Jacket, by Stanley Kubrick?
Certainly.
And you know the opening, you have all the different heads.
Yeah.
With all different kinds of haircuts, and they all get their heads shaven.
Yeah.
And by the shot of just all the shaven heads. Well, first year, or like kind of your, like, you know, the first few weeks of art school, you have all manner of people into all different kinds of things. And by the next year, either because those who can't fit into it have dropped out, but most people have entirely conformed. And you've got to bear in mind, I think that, well, certainly like when I went to art school, the majority of students would have been 18, 19-year-old kids. That is straight from the school system. So they defer to the authority of the tutor. Now, that you'd have seen a lot of, they were mainly girls, by the way, and, you know, a lot of them, the first year, they would be doing paintings, they might be doing a bit of sculpture, they might be doing textile work, you know. The next year, they're doing photo montages of their genitals all cut up, you know, exploring their sexuality, bloody, bloody. Oh, it's challenging and daring.
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, it's made quite clear that you have to conform to that. There isn't room, there isn't diversity.
Exactly. So although art, to a certain degree, or modern art, then, is supposed to have a liberating tendency. It's about,
yes,
you know, freeing your mind. But what you're saying is that there is another very, very rigid conformity within the regulated rebellion of these newly educated artists.
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of this comes down to, I mean, something I'm very, very much interested in, the idea is how history is written by the victors. And the view we have of what modern art is, it tends to follow a particular line. But it omits a hell of a lot of what was actually going on at the birth of modern art. So it's become very, very much a kind of a monocultural approach. That is, as far as I can see, it's just the Marcel Duchamp urinal being exhibited again and again and again. You know, but the central thing that you find is there's fundamentally an attack on craft. That is talent. That is something that is beautifully made. That is something that you have to work very, very hard at. There's an attack on beauty. There's an attack on freedom of expression. For example, any art that, like, say, you mentioned one of my paintings, Henrik. Now, in art school, that would have been dismissed as fantasy. Oh, that's just fantasy art, you know,
right,
for people
right.
who like comics.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that all art, well, with the exception of, like, say, portraiture and hunting scenes, but almost all art, not just in European art, but all over the world, folk arts, indigenous folk craft arts, would have been classed as fantasy art because it would have had mythological or spiritual resonance. So what you've actually had is a kind of an absolute dismissal of what art was for men since time immemorial up to 100 years ago. And where I really, really butt my head up against the wall here is because this approach in absolutely dismissing craft and dismissing the importance, say, of craftsmanship, of talent, of beauty, if essentially you're asked to just cite the, it was very, very much when I was in university, very much the Frankfurt School, and very much the soi-disant-huiter, the postmodernists. And, you know, I have a bit of a problem accepting that, you know, Michelangelo and Raphael and Titian and all these guys, that they were burdened by their talents. And, you know, they wouldn't have wasted their time painting the Sistine Chapel ceiling had they had the Frankfurt School to tell them how pointless it all was.
Right.
If only they knew, you know, they just wouldn't have bothered. Like, if only, say, like, you know, J.S. Bach or Beethoven taught like John Cage, and they would have just had silence. Yes, because they were always hearing something. Oh, yes, yes. Oh, no, very, very clever. Thank you. No, go away.
Wow.
It's very exasperating.
Tell us a little bit more about the Frankfurt School, for those who don't know. I mean, we've talked about this briefly in the past with, you know, John Coleman and some of the other people, you know, that have been writing on this. But what is the Frankfurt School, and what influence do they have then in art specifically? And if you want to extend that further out in other fields, please do so as well.
Yeah. Well, essentially, the Frankfurt School were a group of Marxist intellectuals operating out of Frankfurt. And following the... essentially following the First World War, which, if anything, proved that some of Marx's predictions about if there was a world conflagration, that the working classes would look across the divide and unite and overthrow the ruling classes. Well, that didn't happen. the First World War happens, and you, I mean, you look at this footage in Germany and in Britain of celebrations, people celebrating on the streets because, I mean, it's a shame. I think it was bloody awful. They were celebrating war. But what the Frankfurt School saw was that Marxism wouldn't be accepted whilst there were, say, notions of national identity, religion, culture, the family, essentially anything that kind of could, that one could hold on to rather than the state and a state kind of a state ideology. So the Frankfurt School turned their attention, you know, from economics to culture. So what you do is you destabilize, you attack cultural things like, say, notions of beauty, you attack traditions, you attack craft, you attack anything essentially that people can hold on to and can kind of like have as a tradition that is outside of the rule of the state. So they moved to America. By and large, they all relocated to the States, where they essentially took over the humanities departments of the universities. So what you had then was the great birth of identity politics, victimization, because the one of their central things, I think, is Theodore Adorno wrote this essay called The Authoritarian Personality.
Yeah.
The authoritarian personality is essentially the Marlboro man, that is the self-reliant, strong, independent man. But they reclassified that as a mental illness.
Wow.
That's insane. That's insane. You're able to look after yourself. You're able to look after, you know, you're not actually, I don't know, you're not deferring to the authority of the state. But I mean, they were very, very, very clever chaps. But bear in mind, you see, the one thing that I think about the Frankfurt School is they're fundamentalists. And like dealing with religious fundamentalists, reason goes out the window. You see, their, like say, their own kind of like bearded patriarch of choice, Marx, his predictions, his prophecies, if you like, failed. So they didn't say, oh, well, he was wrong. They simply remodified their approach to it. This is what fundamentalists will do. You know, they're not going to kind of like say, oh, no, because they're not going to change their worldview. So essentially, they got into the universities. And a lot of the social dissent that we've been, in many ways, conditioned into viewing as a kind of a heroic, spontaneous act, like, say, the student uprisings of, like, 68, which, I mean, I always thought, you know, because I was born in the 70s, I always thought that was, like, you know, to do with Vietnam.
Right.
And therefore, kind of, like, say, an honorable protest against a grotesque war. It wasn't. It was more about agitation. It was more about, essentially, the destruction of the institutions of learning. Hamstringing institutions of learning with these ridiculous things like, say, gender studies and kind of all these other, I mean, I think completely and utterly non-subjects. That's fine. That it's fine to be aware of these things and to look at and explore these things. But when you, I mean, like when I was in art school, rather than teaching art history, which is what they would have done, say, 100 years ago or what have you, they taught something called visual culture. And the first term of visual culture was devoted to something called gender and the gaze. Now, the majority of the pupils, I'd say about 70 or 80% of the pupils were young girls. So what they were inculcating was a sense of victimhood. These identified the fact that you're a victim, gender, the gaze, this is everything. And, you know, in fairness to most of these girls, you know, they'd sit there and say, yeah, but what the hell has this got to do with art?
Right. Yep.
You know, I'm not on a gender studies course, I'm on an art course. And what essentially the Frankfurt School and their acolytes did was they replaced all of these other subjects with essentially the onus on victimization and alienation. So you kind of you identify yourself by your victim status and your victimhood, and then you're in a constant state of antagonism because of being a victim. Because after all, if you are identifying yourself as a victim, you're always going to feel you're always going to look for a savior.
Yeah.
And that's essentially, I think, what they were kind of ultimately aiming for. Well, along comes the state or the corporation, the corporate world, whatever, to look after you.
Interesting. Now, there are, if we look at the Frankfurt School, obviously, there's a deep tradition of psychology within that. They have, a Freudian slant to things, but it's also been an outcropping towards, well, I would say the subversion and the subversion of sexuality, basically. This is the focus, right?
Yeah, well, there is, or to actually to just purely sexualize everything. I mean, this is the thing that comes through very, very much from Freud, which, I mean, I always found, frankly, absurd, the idea that the imperative, the first imperative of an infant is sexual. What, not warmth, not protection, not feeding?
Yeah.
But, I mean, what it is I think the focus on the sexual is largely to sow dissent, so you have wars, you have like straight people fighting gay people, you have men fighting women, so there's unease constantly. But also in putting a focus on the sexual, it's in order to get us to identify ourselves as being governed by our appetites. Not masters or mistresses of our appetites, but purely our appetites, which is very, very much a Freudian view. That we are effectively a collection of appetites, you know. We have these phases that essentially everything is down to these appetites that we don't particularly understand and can't control.
Yeah. Now let's see here. So there's a division here. Focus on division to divide people, antagonism, and within that there is. We can talk a little bit more about that, but the identity, how important that is, and that your focus becomes of the division of these different groups, and then you're fighting within different groups. In a way, then, that's that could be termed a class warfare, right? You divide yourself into different classes, and then it's about fighting with everyone else that's different from you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is it, you know, and also as well, do you increase a sense of difference? Do you increase a sense that... that you have to protect your interests and your group identity interests. You know, I mean, it's what I think to me the most disturbing thing about all of that is this debate is common humanity.
Yeah.
It's a very, very poisonous view of human nature that we're all these kind of effectively vicious, non-empathic beings just trying to forward our own agendas. But I think that because I think that that approach is in itself kind of sociopathic, in that it's looking at people, it's looking at groups as being forces that you manipulate essentially to your own ends. That's all. But I mean, the great problem of all of this division and all this identity is who decides? Who decides basically what your identity is? There was this, I mentioned it in that talk I gave the other week, this essay written by Norman Mailer in 1957 called The White Negro. And this was about the European American who adopts the slang and the way of speech and the dress sense and the musical sense of the African American, say jazz aficionado. Now, what it's very interesting, see, because this essay it seems to me to give signposts of many of these like very, very lamentable traits that have happened in culture. Like, say, Mailer opens his essay with saying, following the horrors of the Second World War, any notion of a permanent civilization is rubbish, which is absurd, because human history is full of calamity and tragedy and suffering, despite or perhaps because of which we've maintained art, culture, civilization, as a sort of a buffer to an order, in many ways, actually, to give form to an existence that's otherwise random and meaningless. There's a line in Macbeth by Shakespeare, and he has Macbeth saying of life, it's a tale told by an idiot, filled with sound and fury, signifying nothing. And in a way, the randomness of life upsets and insults our innate aesthetic sense of beauty and form, and I think that's one of the reasons why we have art. Now, what Mailer does with this essay is he makes three central assertions. I mean, it's actually kind of unbelievable reading it, the way the language he uses, supposedly kind of like praising jazz culture. He's going on about, like, say, the jazz musician living in the eternal present and the primitivism. And I'm wondering, like, obviously this guy never tried to play jazz, because jazz is a very, very technically and intellectually demanding form. You can't just like fake it.
Yeah.
You know, he certainly never listened to it properly. That's all I can say. But what it's more sinister than that. What he's trying to do is he's imposing his own view of primitivism, a very, very racist view, on African American musicians and culture, and then celebrating that and saying that is the authentic version.
Right.
And this hasn't just happened with, say, African American culture. This has happened with most kind of, like, say, especially most kinds of working class culture and most youth rebellion culture,
which
is almost entirely manufactured.
Well, that's, I mean, youth rebellion, the counterculture, this has been one of the most powerful forces within, the corporate structure, with all the focus groups and everything that's been going on. They know that that is the most powerful energy that you can harness, so that the corporate world has done everything it can to try to, you know, control that or get in on that, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hilarious, and it's hilarious, this rebellion by the rules, this rebellion with the T-shirt to show that you're a rebel. And I mean, it's one of these things I have to pinch myself. I can't believe that it is still kind of going on. It's still being sold in that way. But one of the reasons I think that it's still being sold, I don't blame a 15 or 16-year-old being sold the corporate rebellion.
Sure.
Because I don't expect them to know any better. But 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, still trotting through the same thing, still saying, well, I consider myself, in the 60s, we were really radical, or I still consider myself a punk. You know, holding on to this identity, this entirely corporate and constructed identity of a rebel. And you're a rebel essentially by what you wear and what you listen to. You know, it's entirely fake.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the major problems with that culturally is that as we grow older, we're still holding on to this self-identification as the youthful rebel. Now, that's all very well, but I mean, what are you going to do when that doesn't? I mean, because that doesn't cover the gamut of human experience. It does. It's not. It's what spoke to you, I suppose, when you're 19 or you're 20. It might still mean a lot to you towards the end of your life, but it's not going to cover all the things that you've experienced in between then, you know? And it also, as well, it means that you're very, very much subject to the dictates of cool and this idea of rebellion, and that your foes are, again, entirely artificial. But again, I can accept this in the context of when it's kids and young adults, because I don't expect them to know better. And because also, the corporate world is very, very clever in harnessing the exuberance and the energy of youth.
Yes.
Because the thing is, any civilization, any culture needs that youthful energy to keep it vigorous, to keep it sharp, you know, so you cut out the deadwood and it keeps things exciting. Because one of the most perfect things of youth is the self-belief and the belief that you can actually change the world. This is a brilliant thing. But of course, all of this is kind of manipulated by the corporate world. And because it's so romanticized, as we get older, we still find it very, very hard to not identify with that. And then we have kind of ludicrous things like, you know, people say, well, you know, 40 is the new 20, you know, and 60 is the new 30, as if it's a good thing, as if it's good that we're still trapped in that same kind of like, you know, I'm wearing the T-shirts, I'm kind of aligning myself with this sort of thing, rather than it actually being a very, very atrophied view of the human experience.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, tremendously good points there. There's so much to comment on within that. The idea that grown-ups are... we have a world full of grown-ups. It doesn't mean adults or people that actually have gained experience. There are people that have physically grown up, but they're still mentally a teenager or a child at best.
Yeah.
So how has this played out then with the focus on, or rather shifting the focus towards a life journey that, if we look back maybe a couple of hundred years or so, was very much... Certainly, okay, there was a rigidness there within the Western world, let's say, but there was still a progression to a certain degree, in that you gained knowledge and experience, you built on what you've learned, and you to a certain degree even venerated, you know, those who came before you, etc. But today it's like it seems to be a rebellion that is all about getting at the core to whatever happens to be a constant within human civilization, family, or if it's sex or whatever it is. There is a degradation of those things, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I liken it to the Maoist revolution, where you would have the teenagers denouncing the adults, but then you'd have the children denouncing the teenagers. You see, because if you're having a tabula rasa every 10 years, what was it Orwell puts it, he who controls the past controls the present, and he who controls the present controls the future.
Tabula rasa, a clean slate.
Clean slate, that's right, yeah. So if you're getting rid of that, if you supplant people from, like, say, if you take a child from its family, you can mold it into anything you want, as happens with in Animal Farm by Orwell, when the puppies are taken by Napoleon the pig, and they only appear later on in the book, and he's turned them into these vicious protectors for him, which is kind of also what Pol Pot did. Totalitarians love youth, you see, because they love they love the essentially the innocence and naivety of youth, because it's one of the reasons as well, I think, that our culture is so incredibly, I mean, brutally disinterested in the elderly. I mean, I find disgusting. It's appalling. The village elders, who in most tribal sensible societies, the village elders, the keepers of the wisdom, who identify, okay, here we go again. We had this, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Okay, be warned, folks. You know, we stick them away in homes. We ignore them. There's no room for them because, you see, of course, they can say, well, hang on, you know, we know what's going on here. We've seen this before. Whereas, I mean, you can't expect kids to, you know. But, I mean, what you do, if you keep perpetual change, it's a little bit like, I mean, that's one of the key things of a totalitarian regime. We keep perpetual change because then people, well, they can't hold on to anything. There's absolute instability, you know. So anything, like, say, for example, craft, because after all, if you're going away and you're learning the cello, the discipline and the immersion involved in something like that, that's a bulwark against the corporate world and the state world and the world of constant flux. You can retreat and say, well, at least I got my cello, I'll go back to practicing my, you know, Bach, you know. But the same could be said for family, for relationships. I mean, if you look at, like, say, the popular culture portrayal of relationships, everything is about, you know, because you're worth it, you can do better. We're kind of eyeing up, kind of, oh, I want a new model, you know.
Yeah.
It's, nothing is about staying with, persevering, because when you stay with somebody, I mean, the thing is, you're arguably, it depends, obviously, if you're in an abusive relationship, obviously not. But if you stay together, you weather the storm, you get through rough things together, it makes you a stronger unit. This goes for families, it goes for people, it goes for humanity generally. You know, that's if we're kind of able to stick together, if we have a sense of history, if we have a sense of, like, commonality, it's a lot easier for us to be hoodwinked. And this is why we have this perpetual change. But, of course, you see, the change thing I find in itself hilarious, because if we're talking about popular culture, we're talking particularly about music, like, say, rock-based music and stuff like that. We have essentially changing haircuts, but pretty much the same in terms of content, pretty much the same kind of thing for the last, I don't know. I think there's been very, very little. If say, for example, if you were to play a pop song from the 1940s, the mid-1940s, say some Glenn Miller type swing thing, play that alongside a Beatles record from 1967, 20 years, and it sounds immensely different. It's another world. Whereas the Beatles thing, from that's now 40 odd years ago, and still the guitar based stuff being churned out sounds just like variations on a theme of, like, the Summer of Love or the Summer of Hate. You know, it seems to have kind of stopped in the late 70s. So a lot, again, this is another aspect of the fake culture with the fake change. You know, I mean, like, say, for example, it was some, I think it was the guy, I'm not sure, but he was one of the guys who was, like, one of the early producers of rock and roll records in the 1950s. When he first heard the Sex Pistols, he said, well, this just sounds like traditional rock and roll, which it actually does. New in terms of content, just fast stuff, you know, except, like, kind of with kind of different sort of vocals. But in terms of content, not a great deal of difference. But what changes is the facade. So not only do we have a culture of constant flux, we also have a culture that's intrinsically fake, intrinsically artificial.
Yeah, exactly. And the question then is if that is the if that also is one of the purposes of it, to maybe ultimately have a focus towards where the ultimate authenticity is in is on focus on the violent, focus on the primal, if you will. I mean, there's a number of examples that we can do coming out of the art world, for examples where you paint with poo, for example, or you pee on something, and that's like the modern art installations. Now, of course, that's the extreme at this point, at least at this stage. But that shows again where the boundary lies of what the new and extreme and oh my God, what we're writing about in the papers kind of thing, right? So
yeah, absolutely. You see, and the thing is again, because what happens with that? This is the whole shock ethos.
Yeah.
And the trouble with the shock ethos is what was shocking last week is nothing now. It's banal. It's bland. It no longer offends us.
Yeah.
We don't even notice it. So we don't even notice when we're in a culture that's hideous. We don't realize just how ugly everything has become because we've become immune to it. That's very, very much by design. This is very much deliberate. But also it means that if you want to make an impact, if you want to get attention, all you have to do is lower the bar. All you have to do is lower the bar and people might write about you for 5 minutes or something like that. You see, I don't necessarily believe that common humanity is interested in this, but certainly the media is. This is what the media will focus upon.
Yeah.
It'll focus upon this absolute grotesque side of things. This is very, very deliberate. I mean, most people aren't interested in, for example, going to a gallery to see a can of excrement or to see a crucifix immersed in pee.
Yeah.
You know, most people aren't, but this is very, very much by design. But you see, the whole thing of like the increased shock is that you're essentially being acclimatized to an absolutely bestial way of being, with the lowest, most degraded version of humanity being forwarded. I mean, remember as well, I think of, what's her name, Jean-Paul Sartre's squeeze, Simone de Beauvoir. She was central in the rehabilitation of the Marquis de Sade. She wrote this essay, Must We Burn the Marquis de Sade? And you know how many of that ilk celebrated the Marquis de Sade as a kind of a free thinker, you know?
Yeah.
Well, if that's free thought, he's welcome to it, you know? But it's very, very much this argument kind of, you know, and because the Marquis de Sade shows us what we really are. And, you know, maybe we're all a bit like serial killers. No, we're not. We are not like the Marquis de Sade. We are not like serial killers. A very, very, very small minority of sociopaths are like that. But the unfortunate thing is the power structure of the world we're in is geared entirely towards sociopaths. I mean, this happens on various levels. Like, say, for example, if you're a musician, if you're an artist, you're expected to sell yourself. It's not so much, well, that's all very well. You've made a good record there, or you've done a nice painting, but you know, you have to get out there. You got to network. You got to, you know, and what does that mean? What that means in essence is you've got to go out. You've got to look at people, judging them, weighing them up to see how useful they are to you. Right?
Yeah.
I'll cultivate these people because they might be of use to me. And you're aware of the pecking order and you're always weighing things up and you have to be hanging around the right people. And, you know, I'm sorry, I think I'm not going to turn myself into Patrick Bateman or to get somebody to listen to a record or look at a painting. But this is the model of, this is how we judge success in this insane world. So that happens across the board, that the lowest version of humanity is the one that's being elevated. And you see, most people aren't like that, but from day one, we're inculcated into behaving like that. That it isn't so much that I succeed, that others fail. You get the gold star, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone doesn't get, you know, I mean, I remember hearing this beautiful story about somebody was in somewhere in Africa, and this is some years ago, and there was a mango tree, or somebody told these kids, and all the children ran along holding hands. They ran along holding hands, and they were all eating the mangoes together, and somebody said, well, why did you all run along holding hands? They said, so nobody would be left behind, because everyone had to have a mango, because it wouldn't be right if somebody was left out. I mean, that's the kind of thing you don't really see. The media doesn't really focus on that sort of thing, the higher side of human nature, you know. But we're across the board, we're conditioned into resonating to, and this is, of course, as well, this is to normalize the absolutely bestial. This is to normalize the Desadian model of... I struggle to call it humanity, but there you go.
Well, I want to get into more of the media here later, but let me take another example here. Then it seems that the strength of the reaction to the art is the measure of the success, if you will. And there are a couple of different ways you can look at this. I remember a couple of years ago watching a lecture by a Ramachandran. I don't know his first name. He's an Indian, comes out of San Diego, I think, in UC or something like that. He's at the Center for Brain and Cognition, and he looked at neurology and art.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're familiar with him, exactly. And he had a kind of an idea there that it was, they solely measured the how the brain fired up when you looked at different picture kind of thing. And he said, I don't care about if you actually like this picture or not. Your brain is going to like this picture, and therefore this is good art. what do you think about something like that, right?
This is interesting, you see, because I think that some art, like say some food, is of a higher resonance. It's essentially better for you. Like say, for example, you know, a kind of an organic fruit smoothie is better for you than kind of a fry up, probably. You know, other people might argue against that. People who have the Atkins diet or whatever, that's fine. You know, but some things are of a higher frequency. I mean, we've all heard the stories. Like if you play a plant Mozart, it'll grow. Whereas if you play a death metal, it'll die. Where this is tricky is because our appraisal of art and culture is very subjective. Yeah. I mean, if we're acclimatized to a particular thing, or if it's especially, I think this is especially the case with music, because of the way music, it goes on around us, you know, and music, like smell, it has this ability to take us back, to transport us back to a particular time and place. It's intrinsically linked with memory and our inner kind of world of associations. Now, because of that, you can find yourself loving things that aren't necessarily that great. I mean, there's a lot of music that I love that I don't consider really good art, but because it's a personal resonance for me, you know. But at the same time, you know, I'd like to think I would be kind of big enough to say, but objectively, even though I don't like that music, I think it's of a kind of a higher frequency. It's more expansive to the consciousness. I mean, I don't know. I mean, certainly if I listen to J.S. Bach, I would say that this music makes you more conscious. It has to make you more conscious because the form is so perfect. The construction is so absolutely perfect. And yet, it is also aesthetically beautiful. And that's just my opinion. But it seems to have a perfect emotional quality, but also a perfect structural, formal quality. But I think I would agree that there are higher art forms and there are lower art forms, definitely. But it's a tricky one, kind of picking them apart.
Well, exactly. And I would say that beyond there being a certain level of objectivity, I also think that there's, we could think about things like, you know, Dr. Emoto about the water crystals that freezes and stuff. And in that case, I would say that it has not as much to do with the actual music, but more of the intention of the person that's performing the experiment. For say, if they don't like death metal, it is going to have a negative exhibit on their environment around them, including the water molecule or what have you. At the same time, I think that would even pass all the way down to the intention of those who actually play the music, and that's coming out through the speakers. What is the intention? Because I don't think you can just say, simplify it by saying, yep, that's it. All death metal music, we know that's wrong and evil and bad, really. So, you know, therefore...
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's it, you know, because also there's all different kinds of music have various levels of consciousness.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the intention that's put into it. You see, this is it. I mean, I don't dismiss any genre of music because I think that it's one of the wonderful kind of manifestations of the human diversity. That you will have seeded throughout all of these different forms. You'll have different ideas and energies and manifestations of human consciousness. I would say that the intention has a lot to do with it. I mean, it's a bit tricky these days, though, because of the whole way in which music is recorded and the whole way that not so much it's recorded, but it's kind of like sort of operated on afterwards. You know, like say if you were recording a string quartet or a jazz ensemble, like, you know, maybe different now, but I mean, certainly it used to be you'd record them all, like say it was say John Coltrane's quartet, you'd record them all playing at the same time. So what you're having is the interaction of the musicians with each other, the same with the string quartet.
Yeah.
There isn't a conductor, it's just the four people making this music together. And it's that wonderful interaction. So I think you're actually, I agree with you, you would have a lot more going on there than the actual music itself. You will have kind of... an infinite world of nuances and interactions and consequently all these other energies and emotions being communicated to the listener.
Yeah. Now, let's see here. What do you think then about? Well, I wanted to get into like some of the things that goes on with music and kind of tie this into some of the stuff that we've seen development wise in the last couple of years when we see like. Well, I would say that it's rituals that are performed on stage. You know, we have one branch of it is the, you know, the yearly MTV, you know, music awards. They're attempting to get younger and younger girls there and, you know, twerking in their lingerie, you know, and all kinds of stuff. And
pushing
the boundary all the time towards what can they do. And the more, the more outrageous it is, the more attention it gets and consequently the more... Ultimately, focus they get on it and they win, right? But what do you think that is really about? And where will this go? I mean, how far can we push these boundaries?
It can get bad. Think of Nero or Caligula in Rome.
Right.
It can get really, really bad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, think of, was it Nero who castrated a boy and turned him into his wife? It can get really, really bad.
Married his horse,
Sorry. Yeah. This is it. You know. And also think of the sacrifice of children and things like that. Human history. These things have gone on. It can get very, very bad. Things can always get uglier. Unfortunately, you know. No. I mean I personally don't go anywhere near that. I mean, I actually avoid most popular culture, to be honest with you, because I just find it just too damn ugly.
Same here.
And I can see how I'm being played. What I find horrendous about like the whole thing of this. Like say somebody like Miss Miley Virus is that her audience aren't teenage girls; they're little girls.
Yeah,
you know this is the thing. It's one of these horrible manifestations of this sexualization of children.
And it's 40-year-olds old as well. On top of it, you know, it seems like it's across the board. It's like you know, I remember hold that thought, and I don't want to try to get you off track there, but I remember when there was like. You know, rock music was considered to be, kind of extreme. During a time when that was in the mainstream, like let's say a little bit after the, you know, grunge era, whatever, there was still a resistant because it was rock music. But the very, very degenerate pop music at this stage seems to go down very well across the board among, you know, ages, you know, young and old. It's amazing to me.
I mean, I don't know, you see, and this is like, I'll have to take your word for it because, I mean, I don't know anybody who actually likes that stuff. Maybe I don't know a lot. I probably need to get out more often.
I've heard. I'd be right. I agree with you in that regard. I have heard from other people who, if you will, from a distance, you overhear someone talk or whatever, or you listen a little bit and you realize that they're maybe around 40, 50 years old and they have no problem with Miley Cyrus. You know, so yeah.
Well, that's they probably think it makes them cool.
Right.
They probably think, oh, look, I'm so cool. I'm not shocked by this. How? Because I'm cool. You see, because to be shocked is to be uncool. That is square. You know, I'm still hip. Even though, you know, it's all this kind of, it's not so much that I consider myself cool as that other people think I'm cool. You know, I mean, or else it could be that they genuinely like this garbage. You know, it's like that they're so, they're so kind of, terrified of the idea of kind of going into a more reflective stage of life, maybe they're just not very bright. I really don't know.
Yeah.
But there is nothing there, as far as I'm concerned. There's nothing there to like. There's absolutely nothing there. And I mean, it's because the pop medium doesn't have to be rubbish. There's some absolutely brilliant pop music made over the years. It doesn't have. You see, it doesn't have to be complex. It doesn't have to be high art to be. Interesting to be exciting and wonderful and sexy and attractive, but what we're talking about here is ugly. It is really, really ugly. It's very, very dark, you know. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't know what to say to if somebody my age said to me that they actually really liked stuff like that. I mean, I'd be inclined to take their pulse. Do you want to lie down for a little? I'll get you some medicine or something. I mean, I don't know. I really don't know what to say about something like that.
What do you think then on the flip side of that? Well, it's really much in the same world, of course, but we have the blood rituals of Lady Gaga, which has kind of taken over like what, you know, metal used to do like, 10 years ago or something like that. And then on top of that, you have of course, we understand that the sensational factor is...
Yeah.
It's 90% of what the marketing of the music is days. And you have a play-in with this, with even the conspiracy crowd. Or, oh, my God, look, there's another pyramid in an eye here in this video. And, you know, it all helps to kind of create that viral kind of sensation. But what do you think is the larger background to those kinds of rituals and stuff, though? Is there something more to that? Is that also part of you know, degeneration of our culture and music and society?
I think that it certainly is. I mean, it's terrible. I'm actually of the opinion these days that if something is on heavy rotation in the mainstream media, it's death, it's nihilism, it's the other side, you know, it's the enemy, you know. I'm a bit concerned, you see, with because people like Lady Gaga and stuff know that they're sending up the whole kind of Illuminati symbolist thing. They're aware of it, they're playing it. And I actually think the best way to fight against them is to absolutely ignore them.
Right.
Absolutely. Don't give them the oxygen of attention. That's the only thing I think because it survives with that. And also, if you're watching that, you're in some way participating in it because your consciousness is going there. And this is something I'm very, very concerned with, particularly with the whole world of violent 18-rated gaming. Because your consciousness is there.
Yeah.
You know, you're hooked into that game in that moment. The same as well, kind of, in the whole, which I think there is a strong connection with the whole gaming thing, with the whole thing of, like, online pornography. Your consciousness is there, so if you're in some way participating, be it kind of sexually or kind of, like, if you're playing the game, you're participating in something. You're actually there. You're there. So I'm very, very concerned to keep myself away from the sewage as much as possible, because you're going to get infected by the ugliness and the nihilism and the sociopathology anyway. So if you can try to protect yourself, I would say actually the best possible thing is to set up a genuine counterculture. And I don't mean counterculture like the 60s, but I mean actual culture.
Yeah.
That is, you know, you start kind of like, you know, pick up an instrument, start playing, or you know, yourself and your friends, like, you know, you put on a night in a pub where you play your own music and stuff, you know, that kind of thing. So you actually set up an alternative to it. Say, look, okay, that's all on the TV. We're going to switch off the TV. We're not going to look at that rubbish. We're going to stop. We're just not going to give it our attention. We're going to, and therefore, in putting our attention into something beautiful and joyous, that increases. That grows.
So a reaction to it should be to create that beauty that you've seen gone
absolutely
lost in the world,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah. And not wait for somebody else to do it.
That's right.
Because everyone's capable of doing it.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that I both take great inspiration from, but I also despair of. It's like human history is filled with the most wonderful, awe-inspiring art and culture. And it's all there. It's all at our disposal. And I have a choice. Okay, right, I could kind of like, you know, I can watch Lady Gaga, or I can listen to, Duke Ellington or Debussy. I know what I'm going to do. You know, I'm not going to give my consciousness to this rubbish. And it's only because people give their consciousness to this rubbish that it would exist, because it's entirely parasitical, you see. It's a little bit like the forces that attack and destroy art, say, for example, the university system and the gallery system. If they were ignored, if no one was going, if no one was participating, they'd shrivel and fall off the face of the earth. It's only because we're complicit in the sense that we acknowledge their existence. Now, I'm not saying that you kind of like put your fingers in your ear and say, la la, everything's all right, but where you can, just try to actually create an alternative to it, which is something joyous, beautiful, inspiring. There are plenty of examples through human history.
Now, before we break in a little bit, let's cover one more area. And then, of course, after that, when we proceed, there's much more I want to talk about when it comes to modern art. And I think we should even define it a little bit more in the second segment and see where it began and how it's developed and everything else. But sure. Let's cover another aspect here first. And it's the contradiction on the focus of death that is obvious within the modern art and the pop culture as well, because I think you are right on both points when you mention, for example, that we've turned our back on the elderly. It's nothing we want to see in the world. We you know, put them away at a home kind of thing. Don't value the knowledge or information that's there, because they're not going to understand the youth movement. They're going to be kind of, backwards and et cetera.
Yeah.
We have all that.
And
there,
even
right?
though we're all going there.
Well, exactly.
Even though we're all going to join them.
that's the thing. That's what I wanted to get to here, because as there is a focus on keeping young, and you have extreme reflections of this when it comes to the plastic surgery, for example, that we see on certain women and men out there. But So we have that on one end, but then we have the identification with, as you said, nihilism, the death ritual on stage, and we have a kind of obsession on the rot, if you will, as well. So how do we explain that contradiction in that?
Because all that, on the one hand, I think actually probably because when you're 18 or 19, you can do nihilism because you have your health, you have your youth. Like, say, hope I die before I get old. That's absolutely fine. When you're 20, you can think like that because your body is full of life and vitality. You haven't yet been crushed by the quotidian. Hopefully you haven't. I'm assuming. You know, but you have all of that energy and you look fantastic and that's great. And you can be as nihilistic as you want. And a lot of the nihilism of youth comes out of, I think, the fear and shock with which the adult world imposes itself upon you. That is, you go from being this little kind of unselfconscious creature to being kind of like beset by appetites that you don't particularly understand. And then these responsibilities. You have to study these exams because you have to get to college, and then you have to get to college, and you have to get the job, and blah, blah, blah. All these hideous responsibilities. So, in a way, I can really, really understand and still relate to a lot of the nihilism of youth culture. But the trouble is, because our culture is so fixated on one aspect of youth, and that is the rebellious side, it isn't fixated on the healthy side. But also, it's fixated on the rebellious side, but it's also fixated on the fake. So as long as you can look like it and sound like it, you are it.
Yeah.
Which, of course, isn't the case at all. It isn't the case, or at least it shouldn't be the case. Because arguably, I mean, like, you know, if you're 40, you should have kind of like quite different experiences to when you're 20. Not entirely different, not like you wipe the slate and that's it. But I mean, the equivalent would be like if you're 20 and you were wishing you were a baby. You know, it's silly. It's silly that you don't acknowledge that there are some changes, there are fundamental changes in how you view the world and how you view yourself. But of course, because we're encouraged to identify entirely with that, and effectively to say that life after that is entirely invalid. That a life where you have, like, say, for example, where there are consequences, where you can't kind of get up to things you used to get up to because your body just won't let you anymore. You'll have hangovers that'll last for weeks and things like that. You just can't do these things, you know. And you know, because we're frightened of that, but also we're in it's an interesting thing, you see, because we're in a death obsessed culture. We're in a culture like full of all this like unbelievably kind of visceral violence and ugliness, but the great and the only remaining taboo is mortality. And what I mean by mortality, I don't mean death, I mean getting older and the body breaking down and our loved ones dying. And that move into that place of where essentially the future shrinks and the past grows, becomes vast behind you. This is the last great taboo in our culture, and it's the great fear, and it's what everyone is running from. And there's no getting away from it. There's no, or unless we kind of like, you know, we manage to ascend or change, I don't know. But the way it's running along at the moment, there's certainly no getting away from that. There's no getting away from the universal vicissitudes and the hurts that come with life. But there's no buffer against them. But because our culture is fake, it doesn't speak for them because it doesn't acknowledge that they exist. So you're encouraged to fake it, essentially, to just pretend that you're kind of getting old, because it's great, because 40 is the new 20, so hey, I'm still in the game, yeah, still cool, still useful, blah, 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 even though, you know, you're kind of like, you're putting a lot of, like, misery on kind of, like, up on the shelf, because you just don't want to face it, a lot of the pains and a lot of the suffering of life. But it is interesting that we have this contradiction, where we're in a kind of a death-obsessed, nihilistic culture, but at the same time, there is no acknowledgement of mortality. But because we're fixated upon the facades.
Well, we'll be able to fix that soon with transhumanism. You know, we'll upload our consciousness to a robot, and then we can correct the mistake of that nature made
nature,
when we have
when
we're growing old, right? So
I know. Well, this is it. I mean, it's kind of like which the transhumanism thing to me looks very, very much like 2 and 2 = 5, the Pavlovian remodeling of man.
Yeah,
you know, that, like, say that the Stalinist model, Anthony Burgess wrote about in A Clockwork Orange, where you essentially impose, I mean, the title is brilliant, A Clockwork Orange. You impose a mechanical formula upon an organic entity that's sweet, that's full of life and vitality, the human being.
Yeah.
Yeah. it's a little bit like actually the whole thing of like say digital recording against analog recording, because nowadays people are desperately trying to get the analog sound without just using tape.
Right.
Because we respond better to tape because we're analog creatures, or at least we're still kind of analog creatures. And the transhumanism, it's again, of course, that's something that you hear in the whole kind of like altitude, kind of those voices like that. That horrible sound.
Auto-tune.
That again is like, yeah, that it's horrible. But again, that's a preparation for a kind of an artificial future, which is, of course, anathema to the whole thing of, like, say, singing, the nature of singing, particularly, like, say, folk singing or soul singing, or, you know, where there's all these wonderful inflections, all these imperfections that are beautiful because they're human.
So, okay, let's see here then. Do you think that subconsciously on one end we have artists then that are in an arrested development state pretty much, where they have a inherent fear of death, but externally and consciously they refuse to maybe admit this to themselves, but that means that the work of art that comes out is going to have a reflection of this. This is going to be the way that your subconscious or unconscious is going to speak to you and the rest of the world out there. Is that what's going on here?
You know what, I really care. If we're talking about, like, say, the kind of art that you find in the, you know, like, say, in the Turner Prize, is that the kind of thing you mean?
Remind us what that was again, about the Turner Prize?
Well, like, you know, like the stuff, like, kind of, like, cans of crap and, you know, so lights going on and off and bricks and things like that.
Right.
I mean, if you're talking about that kind of model of art, I actually don't, I can't put my head into that kind of place. Because I'm not flexible enough to get my head that far up myself, if you know what I mean. I actually think that these people will just do anything for success. So I don't think I don't believe that they're reflective enough.
I see. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that, I know that that's a very, very brutal kind of. That's a very, very broad statement, and it's quite a challenge. But I would stand by it. I would say that because our culture celebrates the narcissist. It celebrates the sociopath, you know, these people who will do absolutely anything to get attention.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I think that these, a kind of a fair definition of a sociopath is somebody who doesn't have self-awareness, who isn't interested in reflecting upon things, who's purely interested in the superficial and in making an impression. So I actually don't know if they really have the faculties really to actually reflect upon what they're doing.
I see it. Yep.
But in a way, I don't know, you see, because I can't put myself into that sort of place. I can't, you know, and I don't want to. I don't really, really want to know where they're coming from. But I mean, I know that if you look at, I don't know if you've heard of Maurice Sarchi?
No, I don't think I have. Name rings a bell, though, actually.
Yes. I mean, basically, he is the major kind of collector and driving force behind what was called the Young British Artists, these people like Damien Hirst and Sarah Lucas and what have you. He's one of the major powerhouses behind all of that, and he's essentially made millions as an ad man. He did this ad campaign for Margaret Thatcher in the 70s. And he was photographed a couple of months ago because his wife is a celebrity chef, and he was photographed in a restaurant choking her, and then pinching her nose. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, if I didn't judge his character as being somehow lacking before, I certainly do now. This, you know, an individual who will actually treat a woman, any woman, like that in public. But I think this is what we are genuinely up against, a kind of a soulless sociopathic elite.
Yeah, there was a husband to, was it Nigella Lawson
that's
or whatever?
That's the one, yeah. That's okay. The one, his husband, Nigella Lawson.
That's right. Okay, yeah, interesting. Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's pick this up after the break here, Gavin, because we have much more to discuss. And again, I really want to get more into modern art and the definition of that. And again, how the progression of that, if you will, and where we are today and where that might lead. Yeah. But let's talk about some of the material you have on your website and stuff like that. You have a couple of different sites that we could give out for people. Of course, that's going to be main focused on, you know, on your art and your music and so forth. But you do have done a couple of lectures as well that's up on YouTube. Do you have any website that you've gathered the clips on and stuff like that?
they would be, at the moment, I think they're just on YouTube, but I am going to put them all on one blog site, essentially. I am going to put these things in one place so they can actually be accessed in the one place. Yeah, yeah.
And we'll, of course, at that point, when you have that link up, we can provide that link. Go to sandsnowmanpaintings.blogspot.co.uk, and there you have a bunch of your paintings up on the blog site where people can take a look at it. And you have, I believe, one for your music as well.
That's right, yeah. There's also, if people put in a search for Sand Snowman Facebook, there's a Facebook page with that as well, has paintings, has music links, and has links as well to some sites that have some of my essays as well.
All right, excellent. Yeah, exactly. Sand Snowman, there's also .bandcamp.com. We'll have these links up there so people can check this out. But okay, great. Well, stay with us, Gavin. We'll take a short break here and then we'll be back with more in a little bit.
From Madame Wong's to Starwood to the whiskey on the strip, you can hear the crashing, blasting strum of bands that come to be real hip and get a record contract from a talent scout someday. They'll sell their ass, their cocks and balls, they'll take the check and walk away. If they're lucky, they'll get famous for a week or two perhaps. They'll buy some ugly clothes to wear and hope the business don't collapse before some stupid magazine decides they're really good. They're a Tinseltown rebellion band from downtown Hollywood. Tinseltown rebellion. Tinseltown rebellion band. It's a little bitty Tinseltown rebellion. A Tinseltown rebellion band. They used to play all kinds of stuff, and some of it was nice. Some of it was musical, but then they took some guy's advice. To get a record deal, he said, they would have to be more punk. Forget their chops and play real dumb, or else they would be sunk. So off they go to SIR to learn some stupid riffs and practice all their poses in between their powder sniffs. Chop a line now, snort it up now. When they think they've got it, they launch a new career. Who gives a fuck if what they play is somewhat insincere? Tinseltown Rebellion. Tinseltown Rebellion Band. A Tinseltown Rebellion. A Tinseltown Rebellion Band. Did you know that in Tinseltown, the people down there think that substance is a bore? And if your new wave group looks good, they'll hurry on back for more of leather groups and plastic groups and groups that look real queer. The Tinseltown aficionados come to see and not to hear. But then again, this system works as perfect as a dream. It works for all those record company pricks who come to skim the cream from the cesspools of excitement where Jim Morrison once stood. It's the Tinseltown Rebellion from down